Blog Talk Radio.
Who are the unstoppable ones?
Is it just that they can do it and I can't?
Who are the unstoppable ones?
Is it just that they can do it and I can't? Mission Unstoppable. Mission Unstoppable.
The unstoppable ones.
You did say unstoppable, right? You did say unstoppable, right? What is it they know that I don't? Coach Frankie Picasso takes you on Mission Unstoppable.
Who are the unstoppable ones?
Can anyone stop these people?
Good evening. I am the unstoppable Coach Frankie Picasso, and tonight we are going on another Mission Unstoppable. You're going to meet a man who doesn't know the meaning of the word stop or no. They say that the Lord will not give us more than we can bear, and I'm sure that at times my guest would say that that is untrue. But because of what he felt upon learning that his daughter had been abducted, has to be the greatest fear on earth, and maybe greater than dying. Stay tuned. Stay close. We'll be back to meet my guest in just one moment. This is the Unstoppable Frankie Picasso. You are listening to Mission Unstoppable Radio on Blog Talk Radio. The time in Toronto is 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, 6 in Los Angeles, and 8 a.m. in Thailand, where my guest is calling in from while filming a new movie with his co-star, Jean-Claude Van Damme. I want to thank Blog Talk Radio for allowing me to broadcast over their network, and I want to thank you, you know who you are, for tuning in to me each and every week and making it such a joy to bring you the Unstoppable Ones. I have the phones open, the chat room's on as well, so feel free to call or write if you have any questions or you want to speak to my guest. My guest this evening is an actor, writer, and director, Joseph Cannon. You may know him from Wildcats, where he starred with Goldie Hawn, Woody Harrelson, and Wesley Snipes. You may have seen him in the movie Like Mike, or as a guest on CSI, Crossing Jordan, or Las Vegas. Perhaps you saw him while in Chicago, where he starred in Livin' Fat, or as a Klingon in Star Trek on The Next Generation. Wherever you saw him, you would have noticed a few things. He's incredibly handsome, incredibly intelligent, and very talented. But these are not his most outstanding characteristics. No, Joseph Cannon is unstoppable in the face of adversity, injustice, and he would do just about anything, and has, for love. Please meet Joseph Cannon. Good evening, Joseph, or good morning to you. It's 8 a.m. in Thailand. Hi.
Hi, Frankie. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, thank you. Really well. Now, we met online about, 3 years ago, perhaps? You were writing,
yes.
I was writing. And we got engaged with your story. You were full on in the abduction of your daughter. But let's just talk about Thailand for a few moments here, because you are filming a new show there, a new movie, I should say, and it's what's the name of it?
The name of the film is called Full Love, and it stars Jean-Claude Van Damme.
Okay, yes. And you play a paraplegic, I think.
Yes, my character Bobby Jackson is the best friend of Jean-Claude's, and he happens to be a paraplegic. He was wounded in the war during a battle, and that's how he ended up in that position.
Okay, and so when you had to get ready for that movie, you spent some time in a wheelchair, didn't you?
Yes, I did. When I found out that I was fortunate enough to land the role, I found out April 21st, and
all right.
Then the next day... And then the next day I went out and got a wheelchair, and then for the next 100 days in a row, I spent pretty much all of my time doing everything in the wheelchair, from shopping.
Did you do the transfers and stuff too?
Everything.
Or did you stand up and get out, everything?
No,
wow.
Everything. Everything for the entire time preparing for the character. Because, the thing, Frankie, is – it's more than just being a person in a chair. You know, there's
mm-hmm.
there's more to the dynamics and the psychological things that I wasn't aware of that this character or just anyone who may be in that position would go through. So, I wanted to make sure that if I was going to portray such a figure that I did some justice and wasn't creating the typical movie characterization.
Yeah. Now you live in Marina Del Rey, right? Is this
correct.
Is this where you did your 100 days? Is that where you were living at the time?
Yes, I did, which was quite interesting. You know, one moment my neighbors saw me walking around, you know, healthy,
yeah,
as they assumed, and then the next day and the next 100 days, should I say, they had to witness me in this wheelchair doing different things. And in the beginning, I didn't even say why I was in the wheelchair. They would ask me, and because I was so in the character, I would even respond to most of my neighbors who were inquiring. You know, when they were stopping, and they would, and you could see the double takes, and you could see some of the, you know, the confusion on their faces.
Now, were some people afraid to talk to you? Did they not meet your eyes?
Oh, most definitely. You know, and it was weird because in the beginning, not knowing what it's like to be in that position, not knowing what to expect from others who would see you in that position, you automatically assume that everyone is going to be friendly, everyone's going to be supportive, because I felt I was no different. I was still Joseph. I just so happened to be Joseph that's in this wheelchair that's preparing for this role, but they didn't know that. I could have been in a car accident. I could have actually had, you know, a situation that rendered me in that position, and it was an eye-opening experience to be in the neighborhood that I've been at for many years and around people that I've known for as long as I've been there, and yet to see this 180-degree turn of how people viewed me, how people treated me, how people reacted to even seeing me. You know, I had friends or associates who couldn't even make eye contact when they saw me approach. And once I acknowledged why I was doing this, then they admitted that they had seen me 100 feet away, but they didn't want to say anything because they didn't know what to say and how to approach it. And that I found to be quite interesting, seeing that I was the one, presumably, in the wheelchair. Why would they be embarrassed or uncomfortable? And it just goes to show you that sometimes when we see someone in a position that we aren't able to do something to help or to change, it can make us feel uncomfortable. And again, this whole experience, not just with this film, but the preparation of that and all the wonderful people that I was able to meet and spend time with and to learn from, and I've always felt that I was a compassionate person. But, you know, as this experience went on from one day to a week to 2 weeks to months to, you know, now it's been 6 months, I think, since this whole thing has started, and it's become second nature to me. But more importantly, a lot of the psychological things I'm slowly, even now, still understanding, and I find myself, I can't say feeling the same way, because I do know at the end of the day I can get up and walk away. So I would never, ever liken myself to anyone who has had to experience that full time. But it definitely gave me a sense of not just appreciation for my life, but I would have to say an appreciation for their lives, because to take this constant indifference from people, from strangers, you don't mind.
Invisibility, right?
I guess correct. I think,
yeah.
Yes, I think when it's strangers, you really don't mind because, you know, they don't know you and you really don't have a connection with them or relationship with them. But when you come across people that you've shared things with and you've done things with and all of a sudden they act differently, then that's when it's an eye-opening experience.
Yeah, you know, I wonder if it's more than embarrassment. If it's, I'm so glad, it's, you know, I'm afraid that could be me, so I really don't want to look. I don't want that to be me. I don't even want to think about it. Indifference over, I mean, it's why we don't look at the homeless. It's why we don't look at, you know, other people. Because we're afraid, I think, more so than, and embarrassed, but more so than you know, just the indifference of it, I think we really, the fear makes us look away. We don't want to be them. We don't want to know about them. And yet all they want is eye contact because it's recognition that they're human beings. They don't want your money. They want you to look at them and just acknowledge that they're there.
Absolutely. And, you know, one of the things that was so amazing, living in Marina del Rey, there's all sorts of people you could come in contact with. And, you know, from your neighborhood grocery store clerk to politicians to successful actors and actresses. And, you know, I was in this wheelchair and I would do this thing every single day. I would go from my home in the Marina down past Venice Beach, down past Santa Monica, come back. And this one particular woman would always come up, and I would see her around. She would get up very early in the morning. She would have her dogs. She would always speak and, you know, would stop the dogs and let the dogs sit and lick my hand and play with my, you know, fingers and things like that. And was always very warm and welcoming. And would just keep right on going and keep right on going. I would see her every day, and this went on for the longest time. And then one day when I was down there, the gentleman that runs Muscle Beach was preparing this event for Memorial Day, and he was talking about some of the celebrities that were going to come and participate. And one of the celebrities was Angelica Houston, the Oscar-winning daughter of...
Yeah, I love her.
So I'm like, oh, really? Is she around here? You know, I didn't. You know, he says, Joseph, you speak to her every morning. I'm like, what do you mean? I speak to her every morning. He says, every morning when you're in your chair, that's the woman with the dogs.
Oh my
God! Then the next day, because you know, you see people. She has her glasses on. She just stops. She smiles and she just talks. And we just. Then the next day, I see her, and all of a sudden now, you know, I'm able to see who she is, and because she normally when she would see me, she would raise the glasses up and start the conversation, and it didn't change. And you know, it's funny because there's so many people that would just walk right on past that wouldn't even make eye contact, but she would stop every single day and ask me how my day was doing, how it was going, and it was just very encouraging and supporting. And supportive. So, yeah, you know, it was an amazing thing.
That's good to know, 'cause I always thought she had a great heart.
yeah, absolutely. You know, I was always a fan of her work. But that, you know, that multiplied for me upon that situation because after experiencing so many friends, not, you know, just people who recognized me, who knew me, but would react so differently. And here was... this person who, you know, I've seen pretty much anything and everything that she's been in, and and she stopped, and it was just a great experience. Again, not because she was a celebrity, but because, you know, this was someone who, like anyone else, could have kept right on going. I mean, not just Angelica, anyone who stopped and spoke to me, I embraced. You know, there was one young lady who used to run early in the morning down the boardwalk, and right before I left, I got a thank you card, and I gave it to her because I used to remember every time I would be rolling down the boardwalk at 5:30, 6 o'clock in the morning, and she's doing her run, she would go right past me and give me a nice little smile and a wave, and it went on like that, like clockwork. And so the day that I was leaving, the day before I left, I rolled over to her and explained to her what I was doing and how her smile and her waving actually, because, you know, to roll from my house to Santa Monica Pier and back, it would take me a few hours to do that. And, you know, and these are all things that, you know, that you don't think about when you're able to walk, that, yes, this normal trek would take me maybe 15, maybe 20 minutes to walk from my house to Santa Monica Pier, maybe 30 minutes at the most. But now to do this in this wheelchair, it seemed like forever. You know, I would have to go and then stop and take a breath. And so, yeah, there were a lot of wonderful people that embraced what I was doing.
Your arms must be in great shape.
Yeah, tired, but They're okay, yes.
Okay, so we've gone from I don't know why I can't say that today, Marina Del Rey, and here you are in Bangkok, Thailand. And you tell me you're in a state of crisis over there. The country's in a state of crisis. The airports have been closed. The country's bitterly divided. Might even be a civil war going to happen. They've shut down rail services. Are you afraid?
Well, you know, it was very shocking when, you know, you hear that there's a state of emergency that's taking place, especially in a country in which you're in a place that you're so far away from home.
Right.
But I know that we're pretty safe. The production, our headquarters, is away from where a lot of this is taking place. Not too far away. I mean, I can pretty much see it from my balcony window where all this is actually occurring. But the security where we are, it has been wonderful. It was wonderful even before state of emergency, and so now obviously it has quadrupled. If not,
are you
know, more times.
A house or a hotel?
We have a hotel. We have like these condos here.
Okay.
In Bangkok, yes.
Okay.
So the entire crew and.
Oh, good.
Yes.
Go ahead.
No, the entire crew and cast. We're all in the same building, so. We all can rely on each other, and we pretty much don't go too far. You know, we have we get escorted back and forth to the set for filming, and brought back.
So
it's like this caravan, yes.
We have this emergency in Bangkok that we need to read about and look and hopefully won't go much further than what they're doing right now, and we stay safe and be able to come back home, and that hopefully there'll be no war. In Thailand, it would be a shame in a country that, you know, kind of on its way back from the tsunami, really, and have to go through something horrific again. So I wish you a safe journey there. So what about, how's your Thai? How can you say, you know, hello and goodbye?
I'm getting a little better at it. You know, for someone who's been here as long as I have to say I'm still quite poor with a lot of my Thai speaking, and I definitely need to get better. Before I leave, I think I will be.
Can you say hello?
A little bit more.
Or?
Yeah, well, you know, I could say, you know, it's you know, there's certain phrases, and it's funny because, you know, at the end of each word or the end of certain phrases, should I say? The ladies say ka, and the guys have to say ka, and it's just, it's, you know, just the linguistic, the phrasing. It's like the exact same word, but it's said differently when it.
So, yeah, on a scale, sort of, like a musical scale, almost. Joseph, you still with me? I think we lost Joseph. Not sure what's going on. Hello? We still got the phone on. Let's see. Maybe he'll have to call back in. Let me see. In the chat room, do you still hear me? Let me know if you still hear, if we're still on air and you still hear me. And we'll just wait and hopefully, maybe that was his cell phone. Maybe it cut out there a little bit. Not too sure. What's going on there? But hopefully we'll get through this and see what's going on. I'm just waiting to find out if we're still on air here or not. Let me know, please. Okay, you can hear me? All right, so Joseph seems to be cut off somewhere, and I'll see. Oh, here he is again.
Thank you.
Hello there. You're back.
Hi there. Sorry
okay,
about
good.
That, everyone.
That's okay. Great. I'm glad that you're there. I thought it was me for a moment, but it's okay.
No, it was me. No, it's funny. For some reason, when I call here from Bangkok, I've had that happen numerous times where calls have been dropped. So.
Oh dear. Okay.
Yes.
Well, you know what? I think that folks understand that, you know, you're an actor. You've written. You've directed. But one of the biggest things that has affected your life, obviously, has been the abduction of your daughter, Shelby. So let's talk about Shelby a little bit and what happened, the events that her.
Well, you know, it was, it'll be 10 years ago this October mm-hmm. when the abduction occurred. This was a parental abduction. Mm-hmm. When my ex-wife, I was raising Shelby in Los Angeles and had full custody of her, I was contacted and she requested that she be allowed to take Shelby away on a vacation to visit some of her family in Ireland. And I had put them on the plane many times before, so I didn't have any reason to suspect that there would be anything suspicious about doing that. So I just prepared for her to go, thinking that she would enjoy herself for a couple of weeks and not realizing that it would turn into this this odyssey, this maddening search that not only the search went on for about 6 years before she was found, but subsequently the court battles that I had to endure in England was dragged on.
Well, let's back
even
up a little bit, because when your daughter was abducted, okay, so your ex-wife took your daughter supposedly on a vacation, and a few hours after you had taken them to the plane, you know, waved them off, expecting them home in 2 weeks or so, you got a phone call from the school where your wife was a teacher saying that your had resigned her position, which was news to you.
Right.
And was that the first kind of clue that something was wrong?
Well, you know, the funny thing was I was up in Canada at the time, and I was working on this film, and when she'd asked me, could she take Shelby away, again, there was no reason for me to ever be suspicious because, you know, nothing of this sort has ever occurred. There's never been any threats of doing something of this nature, nor had we fought, though we were separated at the time. Everything was quite amicable. So there was no need for me to even doubt, even when the numbers I called. See, before I found out from the school, I have to take you back to where I was speaking to Shelby in Ireland and Catherine every day when they were there. And then one day I called and the numbers were changed. And
wow.
And I'm thinking, you know, something's wrong. I'm thinking maybe, you know what, there's something going on with the system. Maybe there's a weather outage or something that has made this transpire. And every number I had for them could not go through.
Wow.
Every number I had could not go through. And then that's when I had contacted the school, because I called them earlier to see if there was a different number that they may have had that I wasn't privy to, and then that's when it was mentioned to me that they had received a letter stating that Catherine had resigned, and that was news.
Wow. What was your first bodily reaction? Did your heartbeat go quickly? Did you want to black out?
No, not really. It was more confusion.
Uh-huh.
I mean, again, there was no reason for me to ever suspect anything out of the ordinary. So it was just like, you know, there has to be some miscommunication. Obviously, there's a misunderstanding somewhere. I just didn't know where that misunderstanding was coming from. So it was trying to figure out what the misunderstanding was and where it originated from. That was the most difficult thing. You know, and because again, I had no reason to ever suspect that anything like this would transpire. It was never anything that ever crossed my mind. Hello? Frankie.
I'm going to hang up. Okay, I think we're back. Let's see what's going on here. Okay, we don't have a caller. I'm still on air, I think. Let's see here. Let's go to the chat room. Sorry about that, guys. I'm not sure what happened. I've been trying to get back on air, and I lost Joseph. I lost myself. It looks like they're still here, though. Yes? I'm still here? Oh, dear. I don't know what the hell. No, it wasn't my phone. I don't know what's going on here. I did lose Joe. Oh, here, he's back now. Joseph, you're back? Am
I
back?
Yes, I am. Yes.
Okay, great. Okay. You know, I'm just wondering, I don't know, is it weather or, I'm not really sure what's going on here. Maybe it's connected.
Well, you know what, it is the rainy season here. This is the stormy season here in Bangkok.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so, and the drought calls happen quite frequently.
Okay.
Yeah, so this isn't, I don't think this anything is at your end. I think this is all here on my end. I'm sorry, I apologize to the listeners.
No worries. Actually, I lost internet connection there for 1 minute, and I'm not really sure why I did that, but as long as we're back and we're still here, that's cool. I apologize to the listeners. We are still on air and still coming to you. So where we left off, I think, was at the moment when you realized that Shelby wasn't coming back, that your wife had abducted her. When was that in the process? How many weeks had gone by? Or
well, a few weeks had passed because she was only supposed to be gone for 2 weeks for the vacation. And the difficulty was once we started to suspect that there was some sort of foul play that was taking place, it was brought to our attention that because I had given Shelby or Shelby's mother permission to take her away to Ireland for the vacation, that officially it wasn't considered an abduction until after the expected time of her return had come and passed. I had to literally wait. Even though she had been gone for 2 weeks, I had to wait an additional 6 days, which I think was worse than the 2 weeks of her being missing because, you know, to be told that, you know what, we can help, but we can't do anything until the actual return date has come and gone. That was confusing to me and frustrating, knowing that they had the power to do something, but they technically have to give them a 6-day head start. Because I had given permission for her to be gone for X amount of time, and I guess sometimes with parental abductions, a lot of times, you know, it's just one spouse angry at the other or whatever the situation may be, and so there's a lot of children that I return a lot sooner that it doesn't get to the point to where the authorities have to get involved, and so they tend to exhaust all options before they get to that point.
So the 6 days went past. You started to work the channels a little bit.
Yeah,
what was
yes.
your first move?
Well, the first move was to contact the State Department. There was a Barbara Gregg at the U.S. State Department who she handles the International Child Abduction Unit.
Okay.
There, so she was the first person that I got in contact with, and from there the ball pretty much started rolling. She pretty much instructed me on the different things that I needed to have done in order to put this into place. Number one, she needed to see if I had custody. That was a requirement, which I did. And then, you know, from there it went down the line far as how long she's been gone, the places that I may have suspected. You know, the funny thing, Frankie, is that technically Shelby wasn't just taken once, she was taken twice, because initially when the U.S. State Department got involved, she was found almost instantly. I mean, they were on it, and within, I think, a 72-hour period, she was actually discovered in Ireland, and the Irish courts had ordered her to be returned back here to America. I had to agree to hop a plane to go there and bring her home, but the U.S. State Department felt, to show good faith, the Irish courts wanted to basically allow the mother to bring the child back, so the child would have to fly back by herself or feel be traumatized at having the child removed from the mother. So reluctantly, I didn't want to do this. I mean, at this point, I wasn't trusting anyone, and my gut proved to be correct, because when they were expected to leave Ireland and arrive in America on a Friday, I guess they left and arrived the day earlier on a Thursday. And what we found out after Shelby being found many years later is that the mother had already gone through a graveyard cemetery in Ireland. She had taken the identity of a dead child from a tombstone, like from the book, The Day of the Jackal. And she had created new identities for herself and for our daughter. So when they arrived in America under the real identities, they then turned around and left under the stolen identities. And then her father went on to do a couple of interviews with the press, basically stating that his daughter was still in the States and his granddaughter was in the States, and all they had to do was check their passports, all the while knowing that they had these new identities and they had absconded to places unknown.
Wow.
And that's what made the battle difficult. That's what made the journey difficult, because here we are looking for Shelby Cannon, and she's a name that none of us knew. Now, granted, we didn't know any of this.
Right.
Even until after she was found, all of this came out. But at the time of our search, everything was
you
directed.
You must have been living in the ultimate hell.
You know, Frankie, you just don't know what to
do.
You don't know where to turn. You don't know where to turn to. You don't. You know, the first step, I didn't know what to do. And I remember my mom, basically, you know, my mom has always had this thing where, you know, she would always laugh at celebrities who took advantage of their blessing and who flaunted their quote-unquote celebrity status by, you know, getting better tables in restaurants and being able to cut in line when other people have been waiting. And, you know, that was one of the things that she always would say to me, you know, if you ever got to a point where you had some sort of status, that you would remain humble and you would never, ever use your ability to get advantages to your favor.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, she said that before her granddaughter was taken.
Right. Exactly.
Once her granddaughter was taken, I remember she called me over and she said, "Remember what I told you about that?" She says, "That's out the window right now. I want you to use every aspect of that you can." And that's what we did. We just sat down and we decided to create a press release, basically, and circulate it, hoping that we would get certain members of the media involved that would pick up the story, because it's very important whenever you have a missing child that the media gets involved, because that's what keeps the name out there. That's what keeps the picture, the face of the child circulating. And you can never tell. Someone may come across and see the picture and recognize them, and your child is found. That has happened in many occasions. And so we did that. And in the process of doing that, a reporter in Ireland named Nicola Tallant came on board, and she started doing all these different stories on me, you know, and about Shelby. And for some reason, she just felt compelled to continue to write stories.
How old was Shelby
search.
When she left?
Shelby was four.
She was four. She's 14 now.
She's 14 now. She was four. Wow. And Nicola Tallant, who, without a shadow of a doubt, is my angel. And without her, there's no way I think I would have been able to find Shelby, because her numerous articles that she would do, I mean, every holiday, every birthday, she would allow me to wish Shelby a Christmas wish or birthday wish or any holiday wish via the newspaper. And at the end of each story, I would always say, "Don't worry, Daddy's coming." Mm-hmm. And because nothing was going to stop my search. In the process of doing these articles, another blessing occurred. There was a woman named Mary Cleary. She runs an organization in Ireland named Amen. It's spelled A-M-E-N, and it's for men who are battered and abused, which is a common occurrence. Technically, yes, and it's a common occurrence in Ireland, unbeknownst to me. And so when she read about my story in one of the articles that Nicola Tallent had written, she considered me to be an emotionally battered man, so she contacted me. And through her help, so many things occurred, because not only was Mary from Ireland, but she also happened to live in the same hometown as the abductor and their family. So that gave me a sense of balance that I didn't have up to that point. You know, prior to that, here I was, this African-American male, trying to get information about this Irish female whose family is very high and upstanding in the community. And so no one was going to assist me. No one was going to do anything to help me any way, shape, or form. And so when Mary came on board, it really balanced the table a bit. It forced people to think
differently
about the situation, and to reevaluate how could this man who had full custody of the child
lose her,
and you know, first of all, how could a man get full custody of his child in the first place, unless something
it's not right with the wife.
It's not right. So
another blessing happened too, right? With Pierce Brosnan.
Well, prior to before Pierce Brosnan came on board, with the assistance of Mary Cleary and Nicola Tallent, the case started to receive numerous attention throughout not just Europe but throughout the world. And I started to get involved in different missing children organizations and with different parents who were struggling to find their children the same way that I struggled to find Shelby. And so I came across this gentleman named Larry Sinclair, whose son was abducted and taken to Russia by his non-custodial parent. And so he was in the process of trying to get some sort of legislation passed to prevent these sorts of things from happening, to bring awareness. And so we met and we sat down and started to talking, and realizing that this plight was much bigger than ourselves. And though I always knew that I would find Shelby, I always felt that this situation was much larger. And maybe my being in this industry was the catalyst to do something different for other people.
Do you have those numbers, Joseph?
Pardon me?
Do you know how many parental abductions happen?
Oh, absolutely, yes. Every year there's over 465,000 parental abductions taken worldwide.
Wow.
And so, you know, when you see those numbers, it's so staggering. And then to find out less than 3% are found.
Oh, my God.
It makes it even more staggering.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to do something about it, and so Larry and I got together, and we were fortunate enough to be able to pass the Sinclair Cannon Child Abduction Prevention Act, named after both of our children, his son, Larry Jr., and my daughter, Shelby. And through that, we were able to make inroads, to continue to get press coverage, to get other people involved, and more importantly, it made a difference. Our law was passed the same time as the Amber Alert was passed.
Mm-hmm.
And so both laws pretty much were passed around the time when Elizabeth Smart was taken, when Samantha Runyon was murdered down in San Diego, when it was considered the summer of fear in mm-hmm. in America, when children were being abducted left and right. And so our law, along with the Amber Alert, was all passed into legislation to prevent this sort of thing from occurring. And very proudly, it has made a difference in so many different people's lives. And
What is the law?
It's the Sinclair Canon Child Abduction Prevention Law. It is used by the courts when determining custody of the child. They can incorporate whether or not either parent has made threats, either parent has a history of retaining the child without the permission of the other child. It allows them to incorporate sort of preventive measures that can assist these things from happening, you know. And it made a big difference. It changed, and it's still continuing to change worldwide. I still get letters and emails from people thanking us for not only creating the law, but how it has assisted. Even now here in Asia, you know, Japan has picked up the law, and they're trying to get it passed over here.
Wow.
So that's a great thing to know when you travel around the world in certain places and things that, you know, you've done. It made a difference.
Yeah.
But getting back to what you're saying about the Pierce Brosnan situation, the law was passed in 2002. And in 2003, the anniversary of the law, we had a celebration down at Santa Monica Pier, and the governor at the time, Gray Davis, and actor Pierce Brosnan happened to appear at this function. And ironically, Pierce was born and raised in the same hometown as the abductor of Navin, Ireland. And I'm not one to say there are certain signs or messages from up above, but I remember when I was getting dressed. I remember when I was getting dressed that morning to go to the anniversary of the law, and I turned on the news, and they announced who all was going to be appearing. And I had been going to so many of these different things, and I was getting kind of tired of making these appearances, but I knew this is what I had to do. And as I was lying across the bed, I hear in the other room the announcer said that actor Pierce Brosnan was going to be there. And I remember thinking to myself, and no one knew but me, that he was from the same hometown as Catherine. So I immediately called my mom, and I said, "Mom, this is a Thursday. Your granddaughter has been found." She says, "What do you mean?" I says, "Trust me. This is too much of a coincidence not for it to be a sign." So I go meet Pierce. The press takes some pictures of him and I. Those pictures made it into the hands of Nicola Talent, the reporter in Ireland who had been doing many stories on us. And she decided to run it in the Sunday paper to get a larger distribution. And she ran in the Sunday paper, and then Monday morning at 4 o'clock received a phone call saying that my child was found, that a woman on vacation in Scotland was in the airport. When she reads this Irish newspaper, she sees the picture of my daughter Shelby and recognizes her as a little girl in her son's class in Liverpool, England.
How incredible is that?
You know, so it's, you know, I have a better chance of winning the lottery than having that happen in that way. And it's the most amazing thing. And it's, you know, again, enthusiastically, I headed to the airport with the thought of bringing her back home safely, and brought to my attention that there were more red tape that I had to deal with and battles that I had to be involved. Because at the time when Shelby was taken, you know, this was 10 years ago, and it's so funny. It's funny how this country has changed immensely in the 10-year span. I have a book that's coming out early next year, and it's written about this situation. It's entitled "Don't Worry, Daddy's Coming," and it just chronicles the battle that I had in finding Shelby and searching for Shelby.
I remember when I first. Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead. Finish, Frankie.
No, I was just going to say, because I want to make sure we get this all in, because we don't have that much time left. But I remember when I first met you, and you had found Shelby, and I was incredulous that the law wouldn't allow you to bring her home in London, that they wouldn't even allow you to see her without a social worker, like you were the bad parent.
Yes, and that's what I talk about in the book. But, you know, to understand the psyche of people, not just in America but around the world, we have to look at this country's presidential race that's taking place right now. The irony was, there's a chapter in the book that says from O.J. to Obama, and it basically talks about how in the 10-year span that these two men, though I know neither one of them, what they were doing at the time affected the outcome of my daughter's life.
Really?
10 years ago, when this country was racially divided or divided along racial lines because of the verdict of the O.J. Simpson case, no one was willing to rush out and help an African-American male who was fighting for custody against a Caucasian Irish woman. That's a lot of the hurdles that I received was because of that. A lot of the doors that were closed was because of that. And I understood that. But 10 years later, because of the success of what Obama is doing now and Barack is doing, is viewed differently. Again, I'm still the same Joseph Cannon.
Right.
But based upon what was taking place in the world around us, it's just like when 9/11 happened. And
right.
Prior to 9/11, you know, certain groups were able to come and go freely.
Right.
You know, for, let's say September 10th, they were able to go freely. But by September 12th, there was this whole different view of certain groups.
Yeah.
And that's what occurred in my situation. And it's, you know, it was the timing. Unfortunately, I got caught in the middle of something that had nothing to do with neither myself nor my daughter, but it affected her life and my search and her recovery immensely. You know, the fact that the mother was able to go through a graveyard and take these identities of a stolen child from a tombstone. And not only did she use these identities, but she used the stolen identities to fund her search.
Now, she never got charged
to fund
with anything,
her abduction. Pardon me?
She's never been charged with any crime.
No, she's wanted in America for kidnapping, but she hasn't been extradited yet.
Because there's no extradition treaty between England and...
Well, no, there is.
Oh,
but because, again, with the more pressure that comes from the media, the more the case is talked about, then, you know, justice and whatever justice may be will be taken care of.
Well, where does Shelby stand today? Like,
Shelby's still in Ireland. I mean, she's in England, I'm sorry.
She's
and,
in England.
And I fly over every month.
Didn't you? You fly over
Pardon
every
me?
Month. Yeah,
every
you,
month,
I was
yes.
going to say, you fly over every month to spend time with her. And
yes.
Did
and see, the thing is, I can see her. Well, the courts, you know, she wants to come home. The courts have allowed me, I can take her anywhere I want in Europe. I just can't bring her to America.
Okay.
Because the mother is wanted for kidnapping in America. And,
which means she can't come.
Right. And so, basically, Shelby is being denied the ability to come to see her family in America because there's a warrant out for this woman's arrest for kidnapping.
But I don't understand how America can't get an American citizen back home.
Well, you know, they can, but sometimes, you know, the pressure has to be put on them, and that's the reason for the book, that's the reason for this interview, that's the reason for the movie that I'm doing, because when you continue to bring awareness to a situation, then all of a sudden people will tend to do the right things. I remember when you had mentioned earlier about how when Shelby was first found and I was only allowed to see her for 1 hour in a room supervised, and that went on for numerous months. I would fly over every 2 weeks from Marina del Rey to London, take the train from London to Liverpool to see her in the room for 1 hour, and then turn around and go back and do it again 2 weeks later. That is what the court allowed me to do for a 6 month span.
Yeah.
And then I went on television in Ireland, and I did the Late Late Show on a Friday night. This is after 6 months of doing this 1 hour crap every other week. I went on this talk show. It was seen by everyone in England as well as Ireland. Put so much pressure on the court system in England that Monday morning when I attended court, I went from seeing Shelby for 1 hour supervised to being able to take her anywhere I want in the world besides America. Go figure. I'm
wow.
the same Joseph I was on Thursday.
Right, right.
The only difference was when you brought the attention to the press and the press brought it to the people in the community and into the world, it's hard for them to hide it. And I think that's why these types of situations need to be out there.
Yeah.
You know, when they went to the graveyard and they took the stolen young lady's
right.
identity, that affected a whole other avenue of people, a whole other group of people. And,
right.
And I met Linda and Jay Foley. They run the Identity Theft Resource Center down in San Diego, which everyone who's has some sort of, whether it's bank fraud or whatever the case may be, or, you know, someone using your credit cards, they go to Linda and Jay Foley for assistance. And what they've done at the Identity Theft Resource Center, they read about my situation, they contacted me, and they found many children whose identities were taken from a gravestone very similar to Shelby and used. And so I became part of their organization as well.
Well,
and so basically, frankly, exactly, you know, but you know, frankly, Frankie, for me, one of the things that I want to do is I don't so much worry about what's going to transpire with Catherine because I think that's going to take care of itself. My goal is to make sure that Shelby is a healthy and well-rounded young lady. She's 14 now. She's an actress. She's picked up in her father's footsteps. I don't know if that's a good thing or bad thing, but that's a choice that she wanted to do, and I'm very proud that she's doing that, and she's very good
at it.
Does
Catherine have another man in her life?
No. I don't think there are men out there that are looking for child abducting, grave robbing, benefit stealing. Young ladies, I don't know. There might be, but.
There might be some, yeah. Like the guys in prison have groupies.
Yes,
When Shelby's 16, is she free to come and go if she pleases? Is she an adult?
Well, technically she can come right now. She's tried to come, and the English courts continue to block it. And that's why, again, you know, coming on to your show, Nicola Talent's numerous articles, Mary Cleary's wonderful assistance, as well as Lyndon J. Foley's assistance through the Identity Theft Resource Center.org, it is bringing attention to this plight, to missing kids, and to Shelby. Ironically, the law that we had passed doesn't even benefit her right now
right.
because it's a Child Abduction Prevention Act.
Right.
And see, she's no longer abducted now, so it doesn't apply to her. But as she knows and she's aware of, that we're very...
So what can we do to help her? What can we do to help her come home?
You know,
London, High Court? Like, who needs to...
I think, you know, to continue to talk about it, Frankie, I think, you know, more importantly, the one thing that Shelby and I both want is the ability to let other parents know. And this is where you and I met, and this is why I love your program. Because Shelby's unstoppable. I'm unstoppable.
Right.
And
yeah.
when you are in a position where you've had something like this occur to you, you have to turn it around, and you have to use it to assist many others who might be going through the exact same thing. And that's what we're trying to do, and I think that is our main focus. We're not so much concerned about Catherine or her family, who are responsible for this. We're not concerned so much about the legal system in England and Ireland that has allowed for this to take place, because we truly believe that we continue to do what we're doing as far as the laws are concerned, being part of many different groups dealing with missing children, to identity theft, to parental groups. Eventually, this will bring awareness. This will bring attention. I mean, the reason why, I mean, I'm happy to be in this film with Jean-Claude. It's an honor to be with such a talented man. But the reason why I took the film is because I knew that the
you get more
press that I would get from this film that I'm starring in can trickle down to the real cause that I want to bring attention to. And so that's basically what I've been doing. I've been taking my resources and using them, whether it's as an actor, as a writer, as a producer, whatever it is. I have a clothing line where all the it's called Canon Wear, and all the proceeds of the clothing line are going to missing children. So it's this is what Shelby and I want to do. We want to bring the attention. I think by bringing the attention to this situation, Frankie, it will thus bring Shelby home. And I see her being home very soon.
Now, does she has a passport in her in Shelby Cannon's name?
Yes, she does. Yes, she does. After having the false identity, the false passport, and even...
Right.
Yes.
So what happens if she tries to buy an airplane ticket? What happens?
Well, nothing. I mean, she would be... Well, you know, because of the fact that, you know, the mother and the mother's family, you know, Eugene and Eileen Collins, they're in Navan, Ireland. Because of them and what they're trying to do to prevent her from coming, I just think, Frankie, again, the great thing about the Internet, the great thing about the press is it's out there.
Right.
And they can't run from it. They can't hide from it. They can't. The blessing that I have is because of everything that's taking place with the Internet, it prevents them from giving her false stories that they could have given to her years ago.
Right. Right.
Because now she can go online and she can do her own research and she can find out everything. And
but Daddy's always been there. Always
been searching. Exactly.
Always
and
been
it,
searching.
You know, so it's kind of hard to explain why everyone in the world, your mother's wanted for kidnapping.
Right.
But everyone's telling you something totally different. So
how does she feel about her mom?
You know, I think she's caught in a quandary. I think, you know, to have the person, the perpetrator that has taken this life from you, I mean, you know, she even had Shelby celebrating a dead child's birthday.
Wow.
You know, so I think as she gets older, I think she'll become very frustrated or angry. I mean, I'm not trying to push her one way or the other because I think that's something she's going to have to make that decision on her own.
Joseph,
again,
sorry, we got 1 minute left. Let's give let's tell folks whatever you want to say to people. You got 1 minute. Go.
I just want to say, you know what, thank you to everyone out there who has been extremely supportive of what we're trying to do with the Sinclair Cannon Child Abduction Prevention Act, that you just keep the faith. If your child is missing or someone, a loved one is missing, you never give up hope. And like Frankie Picasso, you just become unstoppable. And you just keep plugging away. And, you know,
if parents
myself,
want to write to you and talk to you, where can they do that?
They can write me at joseph@josephcannon.com.
And that's Joseph with an S-E-F, not a P-H?
Yes. Yes. josef@josephcannon.com.
Great. Thank you so much. It's been Joseph Cannon. It's been my guest this evening. Actor, human rights activist, father. Thank you so much for joining me. You've been calling in from Thailand. This is Coach Picasso. Next week we'll be back on Mission Unstoppable. I'll see you then. Thanks very much. Thank you so much, Joseph, for coming on. Take care. God bless.
Thank you, Frankie. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.